Welcome to The Final Word, a Bible teaching ministry with pastor, teacher, and author Jim Andrews. The Final Word is grounded on the invincible conviction that what the Bible teaches, God teaches, and that is the last word. On this program, truth still matters. The Bible is in, Babel is out. The Final Word is funded by listeners like you. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about the program, please go to our website at thefinalwordradio.com. There you'll find archives so you can listen to any program you may have missed. Visit us on Facebook at The Final Word Radio and write us a note. We love hearing from our listeners. We'll provide other contact information at the end of the program, so have your pen ready. And now, Jim Andrews continues his study of God's Word.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us on The Final Word. We continue with our exposition of the book of Proverbs today. We pick up with Proverbs chapter 16, verse 25, where Solomon says, "There is a way which seems right to a man, but its end is the way of death." We've seen that theme before. It repeats and redlines the previous mention of this maxim. It is a wise warning against the kind of subjectivity, the kind of impetuosity that jumps to a premature conclusion that what feels right or seems right is necessarily the right thing to do. We must heed this. Debbie Boone, as I'm sure many of my listeners will remember, famously sang, "If it feels so right, how can it be so wrong?" or words to that effect. The answer is easily. We must learn that the benchmark for what is right or wrong, true or false, wise or foolish, is not, I repeat, not the way things seem to us or feel to us. But insofar as God's Word speaks about a subject, what it teaches, that's the last word. That's the final word. The way we feel or the way things seem to us can be far too easily influenced by cultural saturation or personal prejudice or rationalization under pressure, so much so that our feelings about things are not always a good moral compass of the direction we should go, or even a practical compass. My wife, for example, is not very good with directions. She now says that she has learned a good rule of thumb. If she is unsure, just go exactly opposite the way she thought she ought to go. It's counterintuitive. I'm not recommending, understand, that rule of thumb. But the fact is, some of the ways that seem right in this politically correct culture are just flat wrong. They're ways that tend to injure or destroy us personally, socially, culturally. It may seem good and compassionate to enable a beggar who can but won't work to continue in his ways. But that kind of compassion, as the Proverbs teach us elsewhere, is cruel, for it destroys self-respect and self-reliance. You can help the helpless and weak, but you don't want to enable a parasite. It may seem good to give Johnny a pass on his bad behavior. Certainly it is easier. But it isn't good. It may seem right to get even with a person who did you great wrong. But it isn't. "Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord. It's not yours. Hands off." It may seem right to call in sick when you're not, but it isn't. It may seem right to give up on teaching the word and putting all of your eggs in some political basket, going out trying to save America from itself, but it isn't. You may call it going out and being salt and light, but it isn't. It seemed right for Saul to put David in his armor, but David knew it wasn't the way to go. Verse 26, chapter 16. "A worker's appetite works for him, for his hunger urges him on." Again, another motif we've heard before. Hunger stands by a figure we call metonymy for all human needs. Hunger serves to motivate the otherwise unmotivated. Need drives us to work and to be productive. There's a broader lesson here in the parenting equation. If we provide for all of Johnny's and Susie's needs, folks, Why should they learn to work, to sweat, to exert themselves to achieve and earn an income? Why? Daddy and Mommy are their sugar tree, and the kids learn to become parasites. Deprivation can turn a drone into a worker bee. Not always, but if anything can, deprivation will do it. So it is misguided or cruel compassion to meet needs that people are capable of meeting for themselves. That's why the Apostle Paul said, if any will not work, let them not eat. Let their appetite work for them and not their parents or their government. We exempt, of course, the truly needy and the honestly helpless. Now in verses 27 through 30, we'll read them together. A worthless man digs up evil, while his words are as a scorching fire. A perverse man spreads strife, and a slanderer separates intimate friends. A man of violence entices his neighbor and leads him in a way that is not good, which is to say godless. He who winks his eyes does so to devise perverse things. He who compresses his lips brings evil to pass. Here is a chain of Proverbs dealing with insignia of what Derek Kidner calls mischief makers. These serve us, one, for purposes of self-examination, for we don't want to be caught dead fitting one of these descriptions. And two, they serve us for the purpose of alerting us, by description, to the presence of a scoundrel in a social or business mix, so that we might avoid them or expel them. In verse 27, one sure mark of a scoundrel, the literal Hebrew is a son of Belial, a worthless person, a person of no socially redeeming value. One sure mark of a scoundrel is the kind of person who schemes and plots to injure others and has a tongue like a flamethrower. I've actually seen people like that on church staffs. I remember one guy in particular. Every church that he had been in had been on fire when he was there, and the fires calmed down when he left. The rascal loved a fire. He just always liked to see something going. And here he would be in a church taking the church's money and working for a pastor and all the time outworking the congregation and just creating distrust. Terrible, terrible situation. It's hard to believe that somebody who is called a pastor and ordained to the ministry would do something like that, but you'd be surprised at a lot of things, and then maybe you wouldn't. You know you've got a scoundrel in the mix when you have someone who by gossip or slander runs around torching the good name of others for the sheer delight of it, or out of jealousy or sheer meanness. We may sometimes be obliged to say uncomplimentary things about another person, certainly. But when that happens, it should never be out of anything but constructive motives. Or, I have an expression we use around here, what we on the pastoral staff have to do that. It should always be administratively or pastorally relevant. For example, someone needs to know, lest they fall into a trap. An organization needs to be alerted about a termite or a canker worm in its midst. A boss needs to know about carpenter ants in the woodwork. In verse 28, a perverse man spreads strife, and a slanderer separates intimate friends. If you have some person who's always driving wedges between people, using their tongue like a meat cleaver to divide friends from one another, create dissension in the ranks, don't sugarcoat it. What Solomon is saying, you don't have a godly person there. I don't care if they're a pastor. I don't care if they're an elder. I don't care what title they may wear in our church circles or any other circle. Right there, you know, you have a perverse person in the mix. A perverse, a twisted person spreads strife. A slanderer separates intimate friends. They're dangerous. They're devious. And they're a huge problem. You should know it. You should watch out. And if possible, you should get them out. Verse 29. A man of violence entices his neighbor and leads him in a way that is not good. What we're reminded of here is that the violent, people of a violent nature, breed violence. Those who associate with them tend to become like them and suffer the same fate that awaits them. It makes some people feel tougher and more manly to run around with bullies. But in the end, they get caught up in meanness and brutality they would never have dreamed of when they got in this mix. They would have been vastly smarter to choose other friends. Verse 30, he who winks his eyes does so to devise perverse things. He who compresses his lips brings evil to pass. Now, what's that saying? People with bad intentions, you've noticed in life, when we were school kids, we saw it all the time. People with bad intentions often convey their malicious designs by sign language, like hand codes with street gangsters or throat-slashing signs or a malicious wink in a social group that puts somebody else down. When honorable people with honorable intentions have something to communicate, they're usually bold enough to look someone in the eye and say what they mean and mean what they say. Generally speaking, unless there's some compelling circumstance otherwise, people who resort to codes, here facial expressions represent those codes, people who resort to these nonverbal codes are usually the kind of folk who are up to no good. So when you see it, recognize it for what it is, and get away from it. 16:31, Solomon tells us a gray head is a crown of glory. It is found in the way of righteousness. As we've reminded you again and again in Proverbs, a great portion of these aphorisms are general truths. They are Spirit-approved statements of wisdom of the way things generally work in God's moral order here on earth. So that is the limit of their truth intention. The vast majority of them are not intended to be absolutes. This proverb is another example. All things being equal, the righteous life, that is one lived in conformity to God's ways and will, conduces to physical longevity. Longer life is one of the rewards. Again, I add, all things being equal. Genetics may not be equal. Outward circumstances may not be equal. You live in a third world country. You may be in a war zone. So very often they're not equal. But longer life is one of the rewards of walking with God, so that the gray head, which stands for old age, is a kind of reward, one might say, for a life well lived, a kind of tacit witness to a life lived within the parameters of God's law and God's will. Now, the wicked sometimes also live into ripe old age, and their gray hair says no such thing. But in the case of the righteous, however, who knows how many times and in how many ways walking with God has averted actions or habits or circumstances that would have to some extent shortened our lives. And that's what the proverb is saying. The fact is, all things being equal, you walk with God, you honor God, and it will put you in circumstances. It will create within you attitudes. It will generate behaviors from you that are conducive, enhancing, to a longer life rather than a shorter life. We all know, for example, without even reading the Bible, we know today that somebody who lives in a grip of passion, who's full of anger and always full of heat, we know the body is so integrated, body and mind, that these things have a bad effect, for example, on the heart. Now, there might be somebody who has a terrifically strong heart, and that doesn't show up. But it can kill you. It can give you a heart attack. Or it can send you down the road in road rage. That'll get you killed and somebody else killed or terribly injured. So that's what the proverb means, a gray head. Ripe old age is a crown of glory. And it is found in the way of righteousness. As I say, it can be found in the way of wickedness, but it doesn't say the same thing. In verse 32, we read that he who is slow to anger, I just mentioned that, didn't I? He who is slow to anger is better than the mighty, and he who rules his spirit than he who captures a city. In other words, there is great strength in restraining the passions of the human spirit. A man who is able to rule his spirit is stronger than he who captures a city. We would think the latter, but controlling the tongue and controlling the spirit takes great strength. There's a beast inside, and to control that beast takes extraordinary vigor. Sometimes people think that by vetting themselves and letting it all go and just spilling their guts all over everybody, that they've been strong. I feel better now. I let that guy have a piece of my mind. Well, I'll tell you something. I know all about a temper. I was born genetically wired with a great temper. I tell people, though few people have ever seen me lose it, that doesn't mean I don't have a temper. I could tear down a house with my bare hands at times if I would just let it go. And there have been times in my younger life that I did let it go, and I take on the strength of Samson. Some things I'm not happy to remember. But I can tell you something. I've had just cause for outrage many times in my life, but I have never, ever lost my temper. I've never, ever spilled my guts all over everybody. I have never, ever let somebody have it that I came away feeling better. I always felt smaller. I felt stupider. I always came away with a dimmer view of myself when I did that. Don't ever let some psychologist tell you that you just need to vent it. No, you don't. Read this proverb. He who is slow to anger, he who controls his spirit, that's what he's talking about. It's talking about putting a bridle on it, putting a bridle on the tongue. It's talking about getting a grip on that rage. Well, he's better than the mighty, and he who rules his spirit is better than he, is greater than he who captures a city. Which brings us to verse 33. A lot is cast into the lap, but its every decision is from the Lord. Another expression of the sovereignty of God. We may cast the lots, but in the end, the decision is from the Lord. That is why in the book of Acts, when they needed to name somebody to replace Judas, as they did so often in the Old Testament, they would leave the decision to a lot, because they felt that they could trust the lot to be the expression of the sovereign choice of God. And if a decision had to come down to that, I don't recommend it. I'll tell you why in a later study. But if a decision had to come down to that, I could easily go there and say, Lord, you're in charge of this. I'm going to flip a coin. And whatever it is, you're the sovereign God. Control the flip. And if it's heads, I'll do this. And if it's tails, I'll do that. Now, as I say, I would not recommend that as a regular means for determining the will of God. I'll explain that at another time, so listen in. We come to chapter 17. There Solomon says, better is a dry morsel and quietness with it than a house full of feasting with strife. This is another of the better than proverbs, which compare the relative value of things here on earth. A poor home, that is, a materially poor domestic situation, blessed with an atmosphere of peace, Solomon says, is vastly superior, a vastly superior condition to a rich family with constant strife. Sometimes, folks, we just need to get better at domestic math. We often aren't very good at addition. Solomon tells us, look, if you must choose, a tranquil home with a little is better by far than a troubled one with a lot. Let's learn to add and subtract. Verse 2, a servant who acts wisely will rule over a son who acts shamefully and will share in the inheritance among brothers. Now, obviously, this proverb speaks to a different cultural situation than our own. But what he is saying is that where the wise are making the choices, blood is never thicker than merit. Many a dissolute son has been disowned and disinherited. Not enough, but many have in the course of history. By the same token, many a faithful and able domestic servant has been rewarded like an heir. Abraham's faithful servant, Eliezer of Damascus, was on track initially as Abraham's heir. Mere pedigree and privilege, yeah, they do give a person a leg up in life, but fidelity and ability combined with wisdom can trump the debauched despite his noble birth and prestigious degrees. A good family, not all families are good and wise families by any stretch, but a good and wise and benevolent family will more readily reward a servant, not necessarily a slave, but a servant, who walks well inside the lines, than own and enrich a son who lives well outside the lines. Proverbs chapter 17, verse 3. A refining pot is for silver and the furnace for gold, but the Lord tests hearts. What an instructive proverb this is. Just as gold and silver were refined in a crucible for their impurities, so the Lord is one who refines the spiritual impurities of His own people. We need to keep that in mind. It explains a lot that goes on in our lives. A lot of things that we might not understand. Why this, Lord? How come you allowed this to happen to me? You see, by various means and testing measures, as the Bible illustrates again and again, the Lord works in us to purify His people from the dross in our lives. Hebrews chapter 12 teaches us that so plainly, that every son whom the Lord loves, He chastens. That doesn't mean that the Lord runs around capriciously beating on His children simply because they are His children. That's not at all the point. But because the Lord does love us, He chastens us so that we might, as the text goes on to say in Hebrews chapter 12, we might at the end of the day partake of His holiness. For that is for our good and for our blessing. 17:4 says, an evildoer listens to wicked lips, and a liar pays attention to a destructive tongue. This is one of those insignia proverbs. Kidner remarks, evil words die without a welcome, and the welcome gives us away. I want to say that again. According to Kidner, well put, evil words die without a welcome, and the welcome gives us away. It tells something about us, by which last statement is meant the fact that one instinctively gravitates to these fountains of slander, and the fact that one lends a ready ear to speech with destructive intent. Well, Solomon is telling us that is telling. That is a touchstone of our moral character. If somebody is slandering and telling lies and we lean into the huddle and we stick a big long ear in there, it's not only telling something about the person who's slandering and lying, but it also says something about our own character that we go drink out of a cesspool like that. People who lap up malicious talk are of the same ilk as those who spill it out. Think about that. Leviticus 19:17 says, do not hate your brother in your heart, that is, wish him harm or ill. Rebuke your neighbor frankly when he is doing him harm, as by malicious talk, so that you will not share in his guilt. So it's not just the big mouth, but it's the long ear that God holds equally guilty. These proverbs, folks, like so many others, are self-measurements. They are like mirrors for you and I to look into and to see what we look like in the eyes of God. If we listen to or in any way encourage this sort of mean-spirited defamation of others, it only means that we share the same moral color. When that stuff happens, we should walk away. And if it's an appropriate circumstance, we should rebuke it. In our church, about a year and a half ago, we set up a healthy communication policy, which addresses a chronic problem in many churches. In the last few years, it has certainly ceased to be a major problem in ours, and that's why we picked this time to do it. It addresses this issue of gossip. It's just something that needs to be knocked in the head. Read the book of Proverbs and see what it says about it when we do it, and when we slander, when we listen to it. It really puts a big smear on our character. Well, thank you, friends, for joining us on The Final Word. God bless you, and have a wonderful day.
The Final Word is a listener-supported ministry. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about this program, please visit our website at thefinalwordradio.com. Our postal address is The Final Word, 4565 Carmen Drive, Lake Oswego, Oregon, 97035. Our email address is info@thefinalwordradio.com. And our phone number is 503-699-9840. If this program is ministered to you, tell a friend about it. We do solicit your prayers for God's hand upon this outreach.